Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Katherine Henderson. It was an unprecedented outpouring of sisterhood. The Women's March in 2017 was the largest single-day protest in U.S. history. It's incredibly difficult to maintain the galvanizing focus of even that seminal moment in our short attention span era. But the issues remain critical, and the organizing continues in the capable hands of Women's March leaders, including Deputy Executive Director Caitlin Breedlove. It's work the future rests on. I'm so happy to have Caitlin with me today for Dread Not, Facing the Future with Less Fear and More Hope. So, Caitlin, my friend, so good to welcome you here to State of Belief Radio.
It's so great to be with you in any capacity, and really happy to be here with State of Belief this morning.
You've just come off this major gathering in Houston of the Women's March. I couldn't attend, but I'm really eager for myself and for our listeners to tell us what happened there and what's on the horizon in the work as we all face into the midterm elections.
Yeah, so I think the theme of really thinking beyond our fear and what is possible feels really important. One of the signs that I had long designed for Women's March that we had not had a chance to debut, we actually debuted, and it's Women Can Make the World Anew.
Say it one more time.
Women Can Make the World Anew.
Okay.
And it's a picture of a horizon. And so it was one of my favorite banners that we had at the Women's March Convention. And of course, inside of my spiritual beliefs, women are not making the world anew by ourselves. We are in deep relationship to our planet and the greater force. And, you know, I think that this latest convention was, you know, an experiment in a lot of ways to see, could we take the ongoing force that Women's March has been able to be in the streets and mobilizations and land it in a convention? So for folks who don't know, while the first Women's March was, as Catherine already beautifully put, single biggest day-long protest, Women's March has been very active in protests and demonstrations and ongoing marches since its inception. And we regularly have between 500 and 650 sister marches. So in addition to having 20,000 or 50,000 in DC often, you know, we had 20,000 in Austin last fall, right? There are large marches that happen all the time. The convention was really different. You know, we see our focus as being a welcoming on-ramp for new activists, new women leaders, women who may not have been in community organizing or mobilization, but know that it's their planet and their families and their lives too, and their fate hangs in the balance, and they want to get in the fight and in the struggle. So the convention itself was 10,000 women participating online, and that's a rough estimate. We actually think it may have been more. 1,700 women participating in person, and for those who put on conventions or conferences, the average workshop, there were hundreds of workshops by so many different women-led groups and gender nonconforming-led organizations as well. And there was a 9.6 approval rating for the workshops, which I really think speaks to the excitement and also just the caliber of not just Women's March team, but our partners doing incredible work. You know, there were trainings on, you know, how you build a friendship model into organizing. Mm-hmm. There were trainings on, you know, how you can think about being civically involved in your small town. You know, there's a whole gamut of things happening, as well as a pre-convening of major, all of the major gender justice groups in the country, excuse me, were invited to participate.
And I guess people can find these workshops on the Women's March site if people want to catch up, right?
Absolutely.
Great. You know, recently, I want to get to some policy issues, some specific issues. Recently, we've seen, you know, SCOTUS render decisions that erode the meaning of religious freedom, freedoms of all kinds, including the right to bodily autonomy and reproductive justice. in ways that cause harm to individuals, to families, and I would say to our collective well-being across the country, for all of us. And sometimes I think it almost feels like it's too late, depending on the day and depending on how we're feeling. But tell us why it's not. It's not too late with all of these issues.
Absolutely. I mean, when I think about it being too late or what time it is, I always think about Grace Lee Boggs saying, what time is it on the clock of the universe, right?
Okay.
So it's for sure not too late. And at the same time, you know, we have lost a constitutional right for 51% of the people that live in this country. And that is extremely profound, no matter where you sit on the medical procedure of abortion. And as my dear friend and your dear friend, Schiffer Bronsnick, always reminds me, whether you're straight or LGBTQ or any age, this is not just a medical procedure. This is the kind of life-defining medical procedure inside of reproductive care. And we know that there are several, you know, as someone who yes. is a cancer survivor and, you know, was sterilized in my cancer treatment, you know, I think about it having never had an abortion or never needed an abortion. That's also life-changing reproductive care, right? But there are, we're actually talking about a moment where I think pulling on our faith and spiritual traditions to actually understand this isn't just about losing abortion. This is about what happens spiritually in a country when you force people to give birth, right? We're talking about forced birth. And that's not only why it's incredibly difficult and heavy, what's happening, and profound, mm-hmm. I think, in a right. negative way, but it's also why it simply can't be too late, because it's just not too late for the 11-year-olds and 12-year-olds who are enduring, you know, unspeakable harm. Mm-hmm. It's not too late for, you know, those who need their lives saved. It's not too late for anyone, for any reason, right, to be mm-hmm. able to make those kind of choices about their bodies. And it's also not too late to fight back against a basically racist, classist, xenophobic agenda that, you know, we have someone like Alito saying baby supply, right? You know, that's a completely dehumanizing term that across the religious spectrum, we should all believe is against our religious values. When you're talking about, you know, making more homegrown babies, essentially, in order to close our borders even more thoroughly to immigrants, even though we really do have worker shortages in this country, right? Worker shortages, not only in the fields, but in neurosurgery across right. the class spectrum. And so I think that the reason it's not too late also is that we are seeing from the victories in Kansas to all these other places we're working, everyday women and our allies are rising mm-hmm. up, are right. rising up and saying, this is a bridge too far. Across the religious spectrum, across geography, mm-hmm. across race, mm-hmm. across class and age. And the Women's March is a major galvanizer of that. So if everyday women who are working two or three jobs, like this young woman, Mandy, I met from San Antonio, who cleans houses, and she left her 2 and 4-year-old with her husband and said, my friends couldn't come, but I came to the convention anyway. Like, if Mandy can do it, I know I can do it. And I know we mm-hmm. have to do it. It's not going to be overnight, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why we our faith and our values, because this is going to be a marathon, not a sprint. We support, as Women's March, the executive orders that are needed. And we know that what we've lost is massive, and the fight to win it will not be easy or quick.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know that you have personal roots in your family in Eastern Europe, right? Mm-hmm. And I know that you've done research there, traveled there, spent time there, looking at anti-democratic forces and how you can really lose quicker than you think, right? All sorts of rights and freedoms, and that we take for granted. What have you learned? Tell us something about what you've learned from those other contexts that can give us some wisdom here.
So I love that you asked me this question, because I love to talk about it, as you know, Catherine, from our So I'm like, yay, I get to talk about this. Unfortunately, the answers are not yay, but
yeah.
I am, I think it's very important to listen around the world whenever we can. My own immediate experience is my mom is half German and half Polish, immigrated here as a kid. So, you know, when I think about what's happening in Eastern Europe, we need to understand the way Christian nationalism and white nationalism mm-hmm. have really wreaked havoc in Eastern Europe, but also the class dimensions of that. For a very long mm-hmm. time, you know, Eastern Europeans have been the toxic dumping ground and the sort of like labor ground for everybody from Western Europe's nannies to, you know, laying the concrete, right? Mm-hmm. And so what you have is, as the writer Jean Hardesty coined the phrase, mobilizing resentment, you know, you build resentment between mm-hmm. groups of people, and then you're able to mobilize that based on race, and also in Eastern Europe, based on ethnicity. And so I think that's a really concerning approach here. I think the other thing that is really important to understand is that I don't speak fluent Russian, but Slavic root languages are very different than English. And so if you understand one, you can often understand parts of another. And Putin, for example, is very lost in translation. He's very lost in translation. I believe that when you look at the literal translations or the really good translations, you come to understand that the rhetoric is not exactly religious and spiritual, but it's apocalyptic. Uh-huh. It's more like watching Lord of the Rings than watching, you know, CBS News, right? So mm-hmm. it's a lot talking about the motherland, the holy words, the meaning. And I think that's really important for religious and spiritual communities to understand, is that that language is not that different from some of the forces in the right wing here, right? That are really, mm-hmm. really galvanizing their base to see the issues as life and death, spiritual good versus evil. It's really interesting to look how some of that then becomes an excuse to completely erode a democratic process, especially because there is so much tainted history and injured democracy in the US that we actually have to look at the fact that, you know, we're seeing people turned essentially against democracy who are not only white, right? We're seeing people say, this has never worked for you. It's a ripoff. We have something that works better, right? As well as the fact that the final example I'll give is that if we compare flyers that the right wing use in rural communities like West Virginia, talking about the fight for the white race, you know, white people dying of opioids, it's not that different than some of the threads of the narrative that Putin used to establish really the chokehold that he now has on a huge, huge country and a big part of a continent. So I think those are some of the important things, Catherine.
That is so helpful. You mentioned a few minutes ago how so many of us live with fear and loss and grief during the pandemic, and you actually faced cancer. And you've talked about that in your Threshold series on Medium. And you talked about how it was hard that you made fewer plans because you didn't know the plans that you could make. And you sort of likened that to the whole country. You said in one statement, the whole country is in a cocoon of loss and disconnection and seems unsure about how many plans it should make for itself. Can you talk a little bit about, if you're willing to, about what this passage for you has been like, and what insight and wisdom you've gained? I know that it's been a time of enormous pain, but also enormous learning.
Absolutely. I'm happy to talk about it. You know, 1 in 3 women in this country will face cancer. I had ovarian cancer. So that's a cancer that 85% of ovarian cancer victims just pass away. So you go through a point in the treatment where trying to figure out, are you going to, you know, hospice or are you going into chemotherapy? Very early in the treatment for me, I have a small son, he's 4. And this was happening when I was 39. So I was a good 20 years younger than most of the women and folks with ovaries who don't identify as women in these support groups. So I say that just to give a sense of kind of where the journey was. And I think for me, you know, I found out some really basic stuff about living, to be honest. You know, I realized how afraid I had been sometimes to say my truth, say the real thing. You know, I've been a community organizer for 20 years. And I think being on that particular threshold, in addition to all of the spiritual lessons and the kind of ancestral guidance and presence that I had in my life, you know, I really realized how important truth telling is to me. And my truth may not be everyone else's truth, but I think our movements deserve us to take risks. I think I was a very diplomatic person before cancer, and I think that's okay. But I also think that I have come to a place where I understand the importance of taking care of myself, saying what I know is true and making that contribution. And I also honestly realized that I was terrified of some of the things that I had to offer, which meant it perverted some of my gifts. I was not a person. I was actually a person, as you know, Catherine, who was like, I don't have anything to say. I've been a writer my whole adult life, but I'm not going to write a book. And I wrote a book that is a memoir about cancer. And the reason I wrote it, it'll be out in the fall, probably of 2023. Mm-hmm. The reason I wrote it was because I was sad and lonely and in cancer treatment using opioids. And I couldn't find very much that was that current or recent. Thank God for Audre Lorde's The Cancer Journals, which I would never compare my book to, but I couldn't find that much for folks like me. And so the reason I bring that up is that shout out to Adrienne Marie Brown, who she and the press will be publishing this book. But when she asked me, she said, like, Caitlin, this could be like a political statement, you know, from the margins about illness and health, you know, these different books. I said, no, I just want it to be a book for other women who are not, you know, inside of a sort of pink ribbon, saccharine, in my opinion, overly optimistic, bright version of talking about cancer, but who are really queer people, single moms, you know, going through in red states, you know, young, whatever it is, we're outside of the margins in this journey. And so I guess what I really gleaned from it is that, you know, we have really specific talents and contributions to make in this lifetime. And they're primarily collaborative, but where we have that specific to bring, that's what we have to bring. And that's what I want to offer. And I also think it's incredibly life-giving. Yes. It's incredibly giving because it brings the community to you that you need, and it helps you create boundaries around things you don't need. And I think it also has just really, I would shout out the Women's March, because the kind of care I got from a Women's March, the kind of health insurance, the kind of medical leave, made me believe feminism is possible in organizations. And it made me want to keep fighting, honestly. Because I thought, oh, this is what we say we're about, is what I what I got there. And, you know, I think that's incredibly generative and healing.
So I could talk about lots of things, but I should ask you, is there a title for this book?
Yeah, sure. Like most people who've never written a book before, and, you know, that joke about writers where it's like, I want it to be out in the world and it to reach the people that need it. But, you know, I'd prefer if no one read it. You know, I'm that interesting mix of extroverted and shy. So the title is All In. And All In refers to the piece you talked about, which was the original zygote for that book that I published on Medium. And that piece that helped me write the rest of the book, with a couple, you know, fairy godmothers and angels in my ear being like, I feel like there's a book in there. Adrienne was like, I feel like there's a book in there. But All In is really, it refers to a final scene in that piece where all the candles I'd been saving, all the incense I had, all the beautiful things I had, I just burned all of it on the altar. Like, it's time to be all in. And I think that All In sounds exhausting to a lot of folks, but I actually think it's much more about how we show up with the actual purpose, understanding how short our time can really, really be.
So that is so beautiful. And I know that our listeners will think, we will all think about what it means for us in this time to be all in. We have just a few more minutes, and what I would love to hear, and I hadn't planned this initially, but all of you on the show today are parents of young children. And you mentioned Gael, who's 4. What's the world you're trying to create for him and for generations to come? Can you give us a picture?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that the kind of world that I want to create for him is one where he can actually be all in. I mean, I say that not to be corny, but in a very specific way. Having two mothers who are divorced, being a light-skinned child of color, speaking both Spanish and English, like, I want a space where he's not passing in one part of a binary around race, around class, around spiritual orientation. I want him to be in a world where he's able to be all in. And I think that if those of us who are actually living at those particular margins are all in, and many other margins, I actually think that we're able to make this world anew. And I think there will be a profound amount of shape changing mm-hmm. in the world, for the world to have to be able to be what we mm-hmm. need it to be. Our children are going to have profoundly different skills, but sometimes we talk about that acquisition, but we don't talk about what they're going to have to lay down. And there's a lot that they're going to get from us, their parents and those who came before us, a lot of mindsets, a lot of ways of being that will no longer be effective. And so I think as much about the world that I want to help in the forging mm-hmm. of, but also how do we make space for them to do that forging? And it must, I think, look profoundly different mm-hmm. than what came before. So, you know, I hope that for our children across the board in terms of their relationship to the actual planet we live on, which I think will change profoundly in their lifetimes, as well as their relationship to old belief systems that they will be making theirs. You know, I think we'll see really large shifts in this generation, and some of it will be about giving them the space to do what they see and know is coming. And I do think it will look really different.
Caitlin, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio. We have learned a lot from you. Caitlin Breedlove is the Deputy Executive Director at the Women's March and Movement Strategist in Residence at Auburn Seminary in New York City. Since 2003, Caitlin has been organizing, writing, and building movements in red states, working across race, class, culture, gender, sexuality, and faith. She's the current board member and former co-director of Southerners on New Ground, or SONG. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Catherine.
Now, before we go, I want to acknowledge the recent changes at Interfaith Alliance as reflected here on State of Belief. With the Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch stepping into the role of president and CEO at the Alliance this week, it's been my pleasure to lead the organization on an interim basis, bridging the conclusion of the tenure of President Emeritus Rabbi Jack Moline and the start of Paul's. I've always been a fan and supporter of this program and longtime host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. The conversations you've just heard are ones I've wanted to have for such a long time, and it's a joy to be able to share them with you on State of Belief. That's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and be part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. And I'm going to ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, take good care. I'm Catherine Henderson, and that's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.